Okay, if we can get going. Senator Frederickson, it's nice to be back in our old State Department's committee room, right?
Well, we're back. I don't know if it's nice, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were wondering the same thing.
I remember spending weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, day after day after day. In the afternoon, about from 3 to 5, was it something like that?
That's correct.
You mean you got done so early?
Nice, Mr. Chairman, you can come to our neighborhood after lunch.
Yeah. Well,
It's nice to be in high school.
This is where I chaired the committee for those X number of years. We're not quite sure what, we only have three bills on the agenda. We're not quite sure, we're waiting to hear from Senator Resk. So, Senator Stumpf, would you chair the committee?
Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. And Senator Cohen, which bill would you like to take up first?
Mr. Chairman, I just brought the folders up here, the cash flow bill. I'm not sure what the...
Senate file 3409.
Oh, yes, I did. And Mr. Chairman, I do have the amendment in front of me. 3409 is a different cash flow bill than the larger bill I'd introduced at the request of the administration. We're not quite sure, obviously, in these last several days as to where we're going. So Senate file 3409, or the delete everything amendment I have, is the entirety of the cash flow language of my other bill, which is Senate... Mr. Chairman?
House File 2037, yes.
3333.
That's the one, because I don't have that with me. And so this just allows us to have another bill on the floor with the cash flow language. And I think I shall indicate in our discussion yesterday on the floor that this is language requested by the administration relative to dealing with what may or may not be significant cash flow problems as the summer proceeds. And it changes the payment dates for payments, the state of the payments required, accelerates the sales tax payments principally.
Senator Retzel?
Mr. Chairman,
everybody has the amendment. It's the A1 amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what I'm referring is the A1 amendment drafted as a delete everything amendment to Senate file 3409. So, Mr. Chairman, just to make sure that's in front of us, okay. And this was not in division, I would move it, adoption of the A1 amendment, the delete everything amendment, just to get the bill in front of us.
Senator Cohen moves the A1 amendment to Senate file 3409. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the bill is now in front of us. Like as I said, accelerates the payment of sales tax liabilities to the state in an effort to deal with the cash flow problem. And Mr. Mossman, I'm not sure. I think there was some discussion yesterday on the part of the Department of Revenue that they were looking for a slight change. Did we ever hear anything on that?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chairman and members, the language that is in front of you now in the bill is the language that was in 2037. It does reflect changes that the House put on. There was discussion yesterday of some possible changes yet to that, but there was not agreement among all the interested parties that the language would do what they wanted it to do. So that is not in here, but this is the language that was in 2037.
And Mr. Chairman, members, just so there's no confusion, as I began to present the bill in the Tax Committee, the budget bill, yesterday, as I began to present it in the Tax Committee, Beth Cadoon from the Department of Revenue came up to me and said that there was some discussion of a possible change that they might need that had been agreed to by management budget. There was no problem with that. I suggested to her that it was clearly going to be easier to do that on the floor if, in fact, that was the case. We never heard anything after that. And that's why I wanted to just inquire from Mr. Mossman if we've heard anything since then. So, okay, and Ms. Fabian has just informed me that apparently the word back was there was no agreement between revenue and management budget, so there's no effort to include that language. So, again, this is the cash flow bill requested on the accelerated payments. I don't know if anybody's here from management budget who would like to testify to the language. I don't.
Is there anybody here from management and budget or revenue?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm hoping members, I can talk a little bit about the cash flow. Mr. Mossman could provide more detail if members would like to listen to that so we have a better appreciation on the issue. We simply gave kind of a superficial discussion of it yesterday on the floor. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn to Mr. Mossman to see if...
Mr. Chair and members, Section 1 of the bill relates to payments to the University of Minnesota and accelerates those, delays those payments by 4 days in each month. Section 2 of the bill would change the timing in which counties would remit property taxes to the state so that those are remitted on the same timeline as they remit property tax payments to school districts, which would get them to the state a few days to a few weeks, depending upon if it's the summer or the spring or the fall payments earlier than they do now. Section 3 and 4 of the bill all relate to the acceleration of remittance of sales tax from businesses to the state. This just changes the timing within the month as to when we get the remittances from businesses with liabilities of $120,000 or more 6 days earlier in the month. It does not shift sales tax collections across bienniums, it just shifts within the month. And one thing that has changed from the bill that was originally introduced, if you look at paragraph F of section 3, this language was in 2037, but this language here would make these accelerated payments within the month, this requirement would go away if the state returned to fiscal health in the by definition defined as the budget reserve account being reestablished under 16A.152, then these earlier remittances would go away.
And Mr. Chairman, members, keep in mind that these are a delay in payments over several days. This is not a shift from one biennium to another. So it's distinguished from, say, a K-12 shift where you're changing the fiscal year. In this case, you're simply accelerating or delaying payments for cash flow purposes. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if members would have any other questions about this.
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, I see that every section except Section 1 has its own effective date. Section 1 doesn't have an effective date.
Senator Higgins, if it doesn't have an effective date, then it would take effect in August.
Chairman, Mr. Mossman, I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if they would have to deal with tuition payments coming at the start of the school year.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Higgins, again, Section 1 relates to the payments that the state makes to the University of Minnesota. This is the language that was submitted by the administration. I assume that it was believed to be an acceptable effective date based on the cash flow projections that they were operating on. We are not currently projected to have a shortage of cash flow in July, but we would start having projected shortages beginning at some point in August and thereafter in the next fiscal year. So perhaps they believe that the August 1st timing would be adequate for the effective date of this section.
Okay, any other questions on this?
Mr. Chairman,
do we, do we know approximately how much revenue is raised by speeding up the sales tax collection? We have done that in the past, and I don't know.
Off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what that dollar amount is. It would not, again, change the amount that the state ultimately gets. We would just get it earlier. Mm-hmm. And what that number is, I actually might have on me, but I don't have off the top of my head.
Okay. Just wondering if it's a substantial amount or... If there are any, is there anyone that would like to comment or testify? If not,
Chairman.
Senator Cohen?
Chairman, if not, I'd move that Senate File 3409 as amended be recommended to pass.
And does this need it? Will this go right to the floor? Or?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Senator Cohen moves the Senate File 3409 as amended be recommended to be passed and sent to the floor. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in the absence of Senator Rest, I don't know, have we heard from her? Okay.
I think we maybe have time to take that next one up.
All right. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2566, and I believe this is a bill dealing with a subject we've learned a lot about in the last week or so, an allotment. There is an amendment, the A2 amendment. What I'll indicate, and I don't know if Mr. Chairman, if members would be willing to adopt the amendment and then discuss what's left of the bill. The A2 amendment deletes sections of the bill, and the sections it deletes here's Senator Rest. Should we?
I don't think we. It's being handed out right now, so.
It will. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Since Senator Rest just got here and we just started this bill, should we take Senator Rest first and revert back to myself?
Sure. Hang on to your A2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, let me just make the comment so people aren't confused. The A2 amendment conforms the bill to the Supreme Court decision. And let me just leave it at that. So if members happen, before I get back up here, to compare one to the other, it takes out sections that would be in, would be opposite what the Supreme Court ruled last week.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Cohen. Senator Rest. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest, we have Senate File 3398.
Yes, sir.
Senator Rest, I believe you also have an amendment to Senate File 3398.
Yes,
the A3 amendment.
Senator Betzel, I think, was going to offer that on my behalf. But I think I'd rather explain the bill.
Okay.
And then before we get to that, as all
Senator
of you
Rest.
Know, thank you, Mr. First Chairman. In January, there was a decision handed down by the Supreme Court, which had the effect of creating a new environment for campaign finance across the country with regard to the way in which corporations can, by virtue of being associations, which in Minnesota means a group of two or more, participate in our political campaigns. I think, come to a surprise to actually to many that in some states that actually didn't make any change at all. Some states allow corporations to participate fully in the political process by giving making contributions to candidates as well as to make independent expenditures. But this was a federal case that was decided, and the Supreme Court indicated that it was a violation of a First Amendment right for corporations in the form of associations, all kinds of corporations, not to have the right to make independent expenditures. They made no ruling with regard to people, corporations making direct contributions to candidates, and so in those jurisdictions which had a prohibition against that, that remained untouched, as it did in Minnesota. A number of us that have been working in the State and Local Government Committee on elections issues and campaign finance reform started talking about what should be a legislative response to that decision. We also had a case filed in Minnesota by the chamber that looked at the statute in 211B that forbid independent expenditures by corporations, and we started working on, in this changed environment, given the Minnesota case, which was just ruled on last week, that in a sense ratified the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, what's the best way for us to proceed. And some people have thought, well, let just everything get worked out in the courts. Some people have thought, well, let's do nothing and just let the campaign finance board, if you will, muddle through without any legislative direction. And then there were those of us that thought that even with the cases settled, that it was an important activity of the legislature to acknowledge that it has a role, and not just to give up that role to the courts and the executive branch. And I don't mean the governor there. I mean the campaign finance board. And so we created this bill, 3398, that deals with setting in statute additional reporting for associations, benchmark reporting, so that we would see when independent expenditures were being made much more frequently than our own principal campaign committees have to report, and we make no changes to the principal campaign committee's reporting schedule. And then we added what we think now will pass muster with regard to the Minnesota Supreme Court regarding a disclaimer. Maybe some of you don't know, but you're not required to put a disclaimer on anything that you send out as part of your campaigns. Most of us do it anyway to reassure our voters and constituents that the material that they're receiving is actually coming from us, and so we make that quite clear, but it has been ruled unconstitutional, and in part at the level at which that disclaimer expenditure for that would occasion the disclaimer was said by the courts to be too low at $500. So we have put it at $2,000, and with the hope that that would be that would pass muster if there was a constitutional challenge. And the court, when they made that decision at $500, didn't tell us what the magic number was. So they didn't say, if you put it at $5,000 or $2,000 or $750, then it would pass constitutional muster. So we've been kind of playing darts on what the number would be, but we're hoping, based on just some common sense about what it takes to to make an effective political expenditure, that a disclaimer that starts to be required at an expenditure of any single expenditure of $2,000 would meet the constitutional challenge, but we have no guarantee of that. We also have some additional disclosure requirements, and that is the subject of the amendment that Senator Betzels indicated he would offer on my behalf. And what the amendment would do would be to limit the disclosure that would be coming from these independent expenditure political funds, which would have to be established in order to make an independent expenditure, contributions that would be coming from corporations rather than individuals. And the reason for that our rationale for that is our focus in this beginning bill on this new environment is the entry of corporations into this realm. And so we would propose with this amendment that the corporate contributions, either from a fund that has been established or its own fund, is the place to start with this, and not requiring the disclosure of individuals, particularly those that give to the so-called 501c4s, which are nonprofit corporations whose primary purpose by law must be something other than participating in political campaigns. And so they're restricted to just a certain amount that they can spend on political activity of any kind. But their donors are people that may well not be part of that or wish to be part of that political activity. Nevertheless, in the bill as we had it written, they would have been reported as contributors to the Campaign Finance Board. So at this point, the A3 amendment removes those individuals, the individual disclosure, but maintains the corporate disclosures, which would be coming primarily from the group they're called 501c6s, which are in the main the trade associations. So in a sense, someone may argue that, well, you don't have a level playing field here, but it seems to me that if we adopt this amendment, that what we are saying is that we are in this new environment, we're kind of going slow, we know that corporations are now entering, and it is that we're focusing on, and we need to take a bit more time to think about the way in which we are, we may in the future require individual disclosure of individuals, particularly in those organizations that have as their primary purpose something other than and are restricted in their political activity. So that is the amendment, that is the A3 amendment, and my explanation of it.
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, I'll move the A3 amendment, Mr. Chair. It's kind of rough indicator. The Supreme Court decision did deal with corporations. I think we should do our best to try to conform the law to the court decision as we understand it. If there's other variances or expansion of those legal principles down the road, obviously, you know, this could be visited again by future legislatures, but I think that right now it would probably be prudent just to limit the changes to those that we know are inconsistent with the law based upon the Citizens United decision.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Betzel. You moved the A.
I moved the A3
amendment. Okay. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, I'm just a little confused because can an individual still give to these independent expenditure political committees or funds? So they could be giving to this fund as an individual, but now we don't have to know who they are. It's only if a corporation gives to the fund that we would have to have them listed for a large donation or an aggregate donation that amounts to $1,000 or more?
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, certainly an individual can give to an independent expenditure political fund, and that contribution would be disclosed. What would not be disclosed is if they gave to an organization, a nonprofit, for example, that then created a independent expenditure political committee or fund, and then that organization put money into the new independent expenditure political fund. That if the individual that had given to the first organization, their name would not be disclosed if organization A made a contribution to help fund an independent expenditure political fund.
Senator Roebling?
And I don't mean to be confusing, but it is a bit confusing.
Well, Senator Roebling. So if we had an independent expenditure political committee or fund, and they actually were a nonprofit corporation, could they be a nonprofit corporation?
Mr. Chairman, they could be a 501c4 nonprofit corporation whose primary purpose is the environment, promoting environmental concerns or any other kind of social concern, and they have they're restricted in terms of their tax status for how much of their the funds that they receive can be put into political activities. Many people who are many of their most of their contributors are individuals. And the 501c6s, which are the trade organizations, those are member groups where you pay dues. Like I pay dues to the Twin West Chamber. And that dues is set, and I am a member. Okay. But most of the members of Twin West are not individuals like me. Most of them are corporations, and the money that would be given to the corporation to become a member of the chamber, we'd never get back that far in terms of disclosure. But the primary donors to the 501c4s, for example, that is what who would be giving those dollars, not primarily for the participation of that organization in an independent expenditure political fund. Their names, nevertheless, would be disclosed if we kept the same language that's in the bill at this time.
Senator Roebling?
I'm trying to figure out because campaign contributions in any form are not deductible. So if you're making a contribution to a 501c nonprofit, but part of that money, and you said it's a small part of it, I don't know how much, can be used for a political activity.
Without violating their tax status.
Without violating that. But how can the individual, they get a tax deduction for the whole amount, typically, unless it's earmarked? I mean, I'm trying to figure that out. Don't you have to, if you're going to separate that, wouldn't you have to independently say, this is for your political action committee, or...
But this is not, these are not...
This is not for your primary purpose of your organization. It is for political activity. And shouldn't, wouldn't that have to be broken out according to the law then? Otherwise, it looks like it's all a nonprofit contribution with some of it going to political activity.
Well, Mr. Chairman, some of the nonprofit organizations establish PACs, which people can also give to directly, and that's separate from their activity that speaks to their main purpose, like promoting nuclear power, let's say. But their whole donor list would be revealed if they gave any of that nonprofit corporate dollars to an independent expenditure political fund, which now the Supreme Court has said they can do. Okay, it's not just for-profit corporations that can do this. This is a First Amendment right that goes across the board. And the issue is the degree to which we want, at this point, as we're entering, again, kind of uncharted waters, but still trying to put some reporting and transparency into this new activity. It's how far do we want to go with that? And with this amendment, we would say that an organization's whole individual donor base would not be exposed simply because they gave any amount of money legally, as the Supreme Court has said, to an independent expenditure political fund.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, I'm still not sure I understand why you would leave individuals out, particularly if they've donated for this purpose to an association in an aggregate of $1,000 or more. You're not getting at the whole donor base, but those that have given a larger amount. Why wouldn't we have transparency for associations as well as corporations?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, there are any number of organizations like those that support the environment or nuclear power or any social cause in which there are any number of people, individuals, that give more than $1,000. But they're giving that money for the primary purpose of the organization and not for the the political activity that the organization may legally participate in, when it is the corporations that are being disclosed. Even though the Supreme Court has said that the corporation is a person, we know the corporation is not a person, and that it is a business activity of some sort or another, and the and individuals within that corporation that would be are not going to be disclosed unless they made direct contributions to an independent expenditure political fund.
Members, we have, since I don't believe this has been heard in
this is the last stop.
Okay. There has been a request for some testimony from the Chamber of Commerce.
Sure.
And Mr. Franklin.
And as he comes forward, Mr. Chairman, I would indicate that you do have a fiscal note, which is why the bill is here. And let me just get my paper. I think it's $2,000, $3,000, and the campaign for the campaign finance board, with regard to it, thinks it needs it would need that for extra postage, but it's also indicated that it seeks no appropriation for that, and that it can be absorbed within its existing budget.
Okay, and that fiscal note, I believe, is at in everyone's. Everyone has it. So. Mr. Franklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Elections Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I did first just want to thank Senator Rest and Senator Gerlach for all of their work. This has been a long time coming, this bill. We've put in a lot of hours. But I will say I'm sympathetic to the concern raised by Senator Rest about having to involuntarily disclose a membership list if the association or nonprofit wish to engage in political activity. And I say that as a representative of a membership association, having raised that concern in Senator Rest's committee. And what we concluded on for our members prior to this amendment was that there's a very simple fix, and it's the fix we decided to do many years ago, which is if we wish to engage in political activity, we would form a PAC, a political committee under the state laws, and any donors to that committee would be disclosed as they would for any other entity. This amendment appears to make the problem worse from our perspective, as Senator Rest, I think, recognizes, because it would hold a corporation to a higher standard than you would for an individual or an association that's funded largely by individuals, and that's a policy choice the state might make. But at its worst, what it also could do would be to create a great way to hide big individual contributions that are made or intended for political purposes that are given to associations, and they would never see the light of day. And that's the concern we would raise. Again, Section 10 and I think also Section 11 have been a little problematic for us from the beginning, but we certainly recognize what the state's trying to do is to get at these hidden political contributions. But at least in our initial look at this, deleting the words individual would actually make the problem worse and not better. And so I'd be happy to respond to any questions, but those are the concerns we'd raise.
Hey, any questions, Senator Cohen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Franklin, to use the Chamber of Commerce, now, can I as an individual join the Chamber?
Mr. Franklin?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I don't believe my chamber has individual members, but many local chambers do. So, yes, you could.
So I could join
Senator Cohen.
The St. Paul Chamber of Commerce. And Mr. Franklin, is there any connection between the Minnesota State Chamber and the local chambers?
Mr.
Chair, Senators, the local chambers are members of the Minnesota Chamber, but that's the only relationship that exists.
So Senator local Cohen. Chamber of Commerce would pay whatever appropriate dues should be paid to the state chamber if they want to be a member?
Yes.
So what I'm trying to figure out, just relative to what Senator Rest mentioned, if you have an association comprised of many individuals, they're paying dues. I think Senator Rest used the example of, say, the Sierra Club, something like that. Does that become almost detrimental to, their freedom of association as opposed to a larger entity's participation in the political process?
Well, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I don't know if you meant that for him or me, but I think it's the structure that determines actually whether you're a member of something or not. A lot of nonprofit organizations say, send us $15 or send us $25 or $100, send us anything, and you're a member. But that's not the same thing as being a member organization like the chambers, which has a set fee schedule as to whether you can be a member. So, quote, being a member of the Sierra Club is vastly different because of the organizational structure of the Sierra Club than the Chamber of Commerce.
Senator Cole.
And I would believe that the Sierra Club is probably a 501c4.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I understand that, and that's what I'm trying to, in terms of your amendment, which seems to make sense, I'm just trying to, relative to what Mr. Franklin testified to as to why we shouldn't do this. Maybe I'll use myself as an example. And Mr. Franklin, if you can help me out, because you've spent more time with this than I have. I'm a member of the Minnesota, used to be a trial lawyers association. I think they call it the Association of Justice. I think that's polled better. But Mr. Chairman and Mr. Franklin, when I get my
do statements, unlike, say, the Bar Association, there's an extra, I'll get whatever the yearly fee is, $365. And it's made clear that, that there is some money being requested for, I forget what the phrase is, legislative work or whatever. And I've always kind of thought, should I call up and say, look, I'm a legislator, I don't want to give money to lobby myself. So now I'm disclosing that I'm a member of the association. Now you can find that out by going to their directory, which I'm sure is pretty available. But in this instance, then, should my name as an individual member of that association be disclosed? Because I'm participating in the political process through them.
Mr. Franklin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Cohen, I believe with this language, there's a high enough threshold that in your example of $365, you probably wouldn't trigger it. But assuming your dues were $3,000 instead of $300, I think that's the concern we raised in Senator Rest Committee, which is that it would seemingly compel a business-based association like ours or a member-based association like the Institute of Justice or the whichever one polled better. That it would seem to compel that organization to disclose a list of at least its bigger members, which is kind of the concern we raised. But now what we're saying is we're going to leave the individuals out and only apply that to corporations. And again, that, you know, what bothers us a little bit is the double standard, but what ought to bother committee members is that it could create a way for you to make a larger contribution to that association, which could then use it for political purposes as a way of getting around disclosure.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Franklin, you raise my concern then, not make my point, but raise my concern. If we take my example, and I mentioned the association dues are not $1,000, but hypothetically if they were, then if I'm compelled to belong to that organization, and I'm not compelled, but it happens to be helpful for professional purposes, and so I want to join that association for professional purposes, having nothing to do with politics, lobbying the legislature or issues here or elsewhere, other political involvement, then my name's disclosed even though I've joined only for professional purposes. And that seems to me to be one of the concerns that Senator Rest has raised.
Mr. Franklin?
And Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator, that's the reason we raise concerns about this language too. And it may be better from our perspective to strike it all together so that, you know, we're sort of living under the same set of rules. But I think, again, I'm raising it to sort of demonstrate this problem that you could have, which is unintended, of course, but it could come up if we're sort of creating a loophole for individuals to make unlimited contributions for certain purposes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's really incorrect to call it a loophole. I think it is a recognition that as Senator Cohen said, I mean, I pay $400 to be a member of the Twin West Chamber, and I belong because I support a number of the activities that it does in the community. But I have no opinion as a member about their political activities and would not want necessarily my name to be put forward then, as Senator Cohen has said, as somehow a contributor to the political activity. And even though, again, they're a member organization that then is a subsidiary of your organization, the same thing happens with the 501c4s, and I think it would be regrettable for any of them, for their donors, whether they give $1 million or whether they give $10, to have a chilling effect on their support for the organization, because as an individual, their names are going to be disclosed when the organization makes a contribution to an independent expenditure political fund, as opposed to, let's say, the Twin West Chamber forms an independent expenditure political fund, and I make a contribution to it that would trigger disclosure. That is, I think, that is perfectly appropriate, and I do it with my eyes open because I know the purpose of that fund. And I think that that is what we're we're getting with this amendment, and I don't think it's a loophole. I think it is a way of respecting individuals who support various 501c4 organizations and want to support their primary purpose, which is not a political one.
Senator Cohen, and then we have a couple other questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I know there are other people like to get at this. Let me just ask one other question just to finish kind of my line of questioning. Let's use another association, another group. Let's be more direct to some of the issues raised by the Citizens United case. Target, large Fortune 500 company, respected company throughout the country, headquartered here. And this is a hypothetical because I'm not a shareholder. But let's say I was, and let's say my shares, my shares were valued at $100,000 of Target stock. Under this language, then, would I or should I, as an individual, then be disclosed if Target Corporation wants to participate in some appropriate political organization?
No. Senator Rust.
Is there an exemption for that? Or does your language cover that?
It would only be the corporation at the corporate level that would be giving that would be disclosing. The independent expenditure political fund would, let's call it the ABC fund, if it got a corporate contribution from Target, it would report, we got $10,000 from Target. There would be no layer above that would indicate the source of individuals at that point. However, individuals who work for Target could also contribute as an individual to the political expenditure fund, but they would not be revealed as they would, shareholders' names would not be revealed.
But Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, my last comment, because then if you took it the other direction, with the individual language and wanted to be consistent, then you should disclose the names of all shareholders holding shares in an aggregate of more than $1,000.
And Mr. Chairman, I would argue that that would be an undue burden on the corporation in the exercise of its free speech rights that have now been given to it by Citizens United.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, and an undue burden on that shareholder.
Yes.
Senator Roblin.
Well, I just keep going back to this aggregate amount, though. If an individual's aggregate amount would be $1,000, but we're just talking about aggregate contribution from that organization, I think I am worried about people hiding under this and making large contributions. So if you belong to the trial lawyers, for example, and I think even there's some other organizations that do this, you don't have to contribute to the political fund. That's an option. But if you want to, you can. But could you contribute a whole lot more and still be protected under that if we don't have to list individuals? So, normally the contribution might be $35 a member would be suggested for the political fund for your 501c4. But you decide you want to give $5,000. Is there any way that we can find out who did that?
Senator Rust.
Again, at the organizational level, there's no limit on what you can you can contribute to individual independent expenditure political committees. I don't think there's any limit, and I would have to ask counsel on this. I don't think there's any limit to how much you can contribute to a PAC or how much you can contribute to a political party. There's no limits on that. There's limits on on what you can contribute to candidates, regardless of whether they participate in a political public financing system that we have in Minnesota.
Senator Roblin?
Maybe I'm not answering your question.
Right, but there's no limits to what you can contribute. But isn't there disclosure at a certain point of the contribution?
Yes.
So that's what I'm looking for.
But you know that you're doing that when you are, Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, when you're contributing as an individual to an independent expenditure political fund, you know that. When you are contributing to a PAC, you know that. And you know the level at which that's going to be reported. We're not making any changes in that. What we're saying is if the new right that's been given, to the extent that individuals have contributed to a nonprofit organization for their primary purpose, that is not going to trigger with this amendment, that's not going to trigger disclosure of them if that nonprofit corporation either forms or contributes corporate funds under the law to a political expenditure political committee. In the same way that, you know, the people in Target don't have to do it. Just Target itself would be reported by the independent expenditure political. We have to come up with some acronym here.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm still trying to wrap my head around that same thing. It would seem to me that if an organization had large donors, that they would organize and separate the political arm of it to protect that, and not be giving to from that pot that's running their organization, would not be contributing to the political action or the independent expenditures. They would create an arm where you would have the donors to give as much as they want and not hide that identity by virtue of giving it through on a, I would assume, even a tax deductible basis.
No,
you could separate.
You can't make a contribution to a political fund that's tax deductible.
I know you can't. That's why, but you can to a charitable organization. But you're saying the charitable organization has to be organized differently.
501c4s, which are
is
permitted.
Not deductible.
Not 501c3s. Right.
Well, if they're organized as a 501c4, and that primarily to be able to contribute to political, then why would people be giving large sums of money for the endeavor? Because that's.
Because
the
they
endeavor
support
is
the
political.
Environment. I mean, I don't. I don't, Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Watson knows the extent to which. Contributions, if any, to 501c4s are as tax deductible as 501c3s.
I don't recall that. I don't think they're deductible at all.
No, they're not. Okay. That's my opinion as well.
Senator Weider, and then we have the Betzel Amendment before us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's a very thoughtful discussion on the policy. I'm wondering if we're going to continue on that.
Yep.
Or just vote on Senator Betzel's motion.
Okay. We have Senator Betzel's A3 amendment before us. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign?
No.
Motion is adopted. Senator Rest, is there any comments on the fiscal note? Okay. Members have the fiscal note, and I think the language that in the assumptions, as mentioned by Senator Rest, that there is no fiscal impact to the agency, that the agency is going to absorb it.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Betzel?
Beyond the fiscal note, I didn't deal with the question.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Just from that, Mr. Chair, and I did hear the bill in the State Local Government Operations Committee, and I wanted to just kind of double check something here. On page 4, open line 7 and 14, it says an association may not prohibited by other law. It says in both sections. I'm just wondering if that's going to create some confusion because it suggest that there might be some other law out there that might prohibit these contributions, when in fact, I think it's quite clear that these contributions are permitted. So what would be the purpose of having laws, if not prohibited by the law, if it's part of these section 43?
Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there may be laws in other states that control some corporations that would be that would apply here. Mr. Goldsmith has advised us on occasion that since the Campaign Finance Board only has jurisdiction over 10A, that putting that kind of phrase in is a protection against statutes that otherwise would come into play. And I can't, that's about as deep an explanation as I'm capable of giving.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, sir, it just seems to me that certainly Section 9 and the question about Section 10, if this does go to the heart of the Citizens United case, so if some other state did have such a prohibition, I think that would be struck down basically by the case. And they can't have those kind of prohibitions.
Oh, okay.
As I understand.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly willing to work with counsel on clearer language with regard to that. That the reference again to any other statute has come up as a technical discussion that I have not yet resolved.
Yes, well, Mr. Chairman, sir, if we could get that resolved by the floor, that would be helpful.
Oh, yes.
Otherwise, you know, I would suggest we consider deleting that clause because it might cause some more confusion, you know, than it's clarifying. So, as I said, my suggestion, there are some laws. If there really aren't any legal laws out there, as a citizen of the United States, we probably ought to consider deleting that clause.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Betzel, do you want to move that amendment? Or?
I'd rather keep it in for right now, Senator Betzel, because I work with counsel. But I will also talk to you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Senator Betzel, do you want to move the bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if there's no further discussion on it, I'll move the Senate file 3398, first and fourth, and then amended be recommended pass.
Okay, on Senator Betzel's motion. Senator, or Mr. Watson.
I was just giving I'm going to give a thought on a solution to that problem. Maybe not to do now, but later. And the basic idea would be to say that Section 10.8.27 Subdivision 13 does not prohibit a corporation from contributing revenue, etc.
Perhaps we
could
have a form
of
to
do with it. And the other point, Mr. Chairman, was just in relation to fiscal note, the title says appropriating money, but the bill doesn't really seem to appropriate any money. So would we want to delete that from the title? Maybe in an earlier version of this
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll withdraw the motion.
Okay.
Page 123 on the appropriating money.
Senator Betzel withdraws his motion and moves to delete appropriating money on line 1.3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Betzel. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Collins.
Yeah, you had asked about the value of the acceleration of this.
Do you have that?
It's not a single answer because it varies in the way.
And that was on the first bill. As we get into the last bill that we have before us, I had asked what the accelerated June or accelerated sales tax collections amounted to, and Mr. Mossman has some information on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members, the question was the acceleration within the month of the business sales tax collections being remitted from the 20th of the month when they are now due to the 14th, what the impact of that would be. It varies, of course, from month to month because as the economy cycles throughout the year, the sales tax liabilities are not the same in every month. It appears from information that I have from MMB that it could be as much as $300 million in some months, and again, it would vary. That would be an approximation. So the way that would work is it doesn't help, again, with budget balance, but take, for example, if school payments, which are often due on the 15th of the month, if these remittances are due on the 20th and are now moved to the 14th, what they would do in those months where school payments, which are big payments for the state, for example, cause a cash flow low point, this would get the sales tax collections in 4 days ahead of that rather than the day after and would change the low point for any given month. I would point out, though, that in the forecast projections right now for April, for example, our cash flow low points get as large as $1.3 billion. So none of these elements in this bill are necessarily a full solution to the cash flow shortages.
Thank you, Mr. Mossman. Senator Cohen, you moved the A2 amendment to Senate File 2566.
I'm not sure I actually made the motion, but let me make that motion to adopt the A2 amendment, put the bill in the shape I'd like to present it.
Okay. Senator Cohen moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Cohen.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 2566 is, as I mentioned, something we've been hearing a lot about, which is an allotment. And my companion author on this bill, Representative Lynn Carlson, and I spent many, many hours with staff in trying to put together a legislative response to what had taken place over the last year. In introducing the bill originally, there were a couple of intentions. One was to stay away from any potential court action and not to anticipate court action, but to try to not interfere in what had taken place last year. We weren't trying to rewrite history. We were simply trying to take a prospective look at what might happen. Now, obviously, the court decision from last week took us in a direction. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I should mention that this bill is being heard quite late because our intent was not to hear the bill until after court action to not give any kind of a message to the Supreme Court as to what they should do or not do, and second, depending on what the decision was. The nature of the decision was such that the bill I now present to you, it has been somewhat, it's still a significant bill, I would argue, but certainly we've cut it back a bit to not in any way contravene what the court's opinion was. But what this does is to provide some standards for the unallotment process. And if members, I'm not sure how many people read the court's opinion and the concurring and dissenting opinions, but if you looked at Justice's Page's concurring opinion, where he suggested that, or he certainly indicated, he didn't suggest outright, but certainly suggested strongly that his preference was to have held the entire law unconstitutional, absent some parameters placed on the law in statute. So I would make the argument now that based upon the Brayton case, that it's possible that absent some type of structure to unallotment, we might continue to have further difficulty if Justice Page was to, again, look at Minnesota's what I'll term unencumbered unallotment statute. And one of the things that I'll mention, members, is that we spent some time looking at other statutes throughout the country to try to determine where Minnesota was in a continuum. And we were one of the few states where we basically had no restrictions on unallotment in the statute. It was just an unencumbered unallotment statute. And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to invite, at the risk of correcting myself, I'm going to invite Mr. Watson to jump in at any point if I'm misstating some of what we discussed and some of what's going on around the country. Without going through the states individually, there are 10 states that allow across-the-board reductions, so they have that specification. Minnesota is one of, I think, only 12 states. And I think, Mr. Watson, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think almost every state has some type of unallotment statute. There might be only, a couple of exceptions to that? I'm trying to recall my list.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, I am not sure about that. Almost every state there. There are certainly a lot that have one thing or another.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, I wasn't trying to catch you off guard. Usually you know the answers to everything. Although this is, I caught you on something last year as well, so I don't know if we're starting to establish a trend in this place. Mr. Chairman, somewhere in my material, I should have looked at this before, there's an NCSL study, and it appears that most states, if not all states, have some type of unallotment authority. The states that don't, I'm trying to glance at this. Well, like I said, it looks like most of them do. One of the things that was interesting is that there are 19 states that require legislative approval of unallotments. So if hypothetically we had one of those statutes, last year Governor Plenty would have had to have sought approval of either the full legislature or some legislative or something, given that power by the full legislature. And in some cases, that's even constitutional. There are other states, and I'm not sure of the numbers, but other states that either exempt portions of the unallotment or they have priorities established in state statute. There are some states, I think six states, that have percentage restrictions on unallotment. So what we attempted to do was to take a look at the gamut of possibilities and try to put together something that would work for Minnesota. And I think our position relative to this legislation is enhanced by what the court said last week. And again, I'm referring directly to Justice Page's concurring opinion. So what the bill that we now have does several things. First of all, we ask that we get a fund balance analysis, which shows the forecast for revenues and expenditures for that biennium and the following biennium. And it's not that we don't get this information, but this puts it in statute and gives us a starting point for whatever we're doing. Second, in terms of a report back to the legislature, and I'm not suggesting this legislation that we go to the 19 states that require legislative authority, but we do change the reporting. Right now the reporting is to the LAC. I suggest changing that to the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy. And the reason is that if members, follow the LAC process, and there are several of us in the Senate, three of us who are on the LAC, or actually two of us, and then depending on the affected area of the budget, for instance, Mr. Chairman, if it's an education issue before the LAC, then you would serve as the member of the LAC for that purpose. An unallotment arguably can look at the totality of the budget, and the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy is a broader commission than the LAC. You've got permanent members, you also have minority members, which don't exist on the LAC. And so we thought that changing the report to that commission made some sense. The other things that we do in this proposed legislation is to put a couple of limits. One is that you can make unallotments in proportion to the payments or the sum of their payments and revenues, but you can't modify formulas and look at the language eligibility standards or similar statutory criteria. One of the arguments we had, and it's not my purpose in presenting this legislation it had never been my intent to suggest that Governor Plenty acted inappropriately last year. That was a determination for the Supreme Court. It was not my intent to make that argument in the context of this legislation.
But certainly one of the things that a number of us objected to was the feeling that with a couple of the proposed unallotments, or the unallotments that Governor Plenty made last year, he changed or modified statute. I think a notable example was the political contribution refund, where he took a program based on statute and had to modify a part of the statute in effect to achieve the unallotment, because it was not just simply an amount of money appropriated. That money was there for people who made a political contribution and then sought a refund. So we're suggesting you can't do that with unallotment. Also importantly, we wanted to make sure that in the unallotment process that there was not the ability to simply eliminate programs, keeping in mind that unallotment is a very special ability of the chief executive. It's there for emergency purposes, and we felt not to be used as a means to get rid of a program that a governor may or may not dislike in its totality, that we put some limitations. First, a limitation of 2% of general fund appropriations. So, and I think this actually does a pretty good job of conforming with the Supreme Court opinion, to the extent that what the court said was that where the legislature and the governor had to balance the budget before you could make unallotments, as opposed to kind of the prospective thing that Governor Plenty did, if you get back using the Supreme Court opinion to where the unallotment power is an emergency power, then a limitation certainly makes sense. So I would argue that 2% dovetails very, very well with the Supreme Court opinion. The other part of section of Part D is that you can't exceed 10% of the appropriation and that no program can be eliminated. So that you can't either eliminate the program or just gut the program. This also does impact not just simply the appropriations, but also deferrals or suspensions, such as a school age shift. So we think that, that those kinds of parameters arguably go back to, I'm not sure I can say the original legislative intent, but in an attempt to try to find out what took place X number of years ago, it doesn't appear that there was any discussion of the kind of broad scope unallotment that Governor Plenty utilized. And in fact, looking at, keeping in mind these percentages I mentioned, up until last year's unallotment, Governor Quay's unallotment in August of 1980 of $195 million was 2.6%. In April of 86, which would be Governor Perpich, his unallotment was 1.1%. 2003, Governor Plenty, 273, his unallotment was 1%. In January 2009, Governor Plenty, that unallotment was 0.8%. So other than last year, I think the history has been that governors have tried to view this in the way that I think this legislation is structured. So I will suggest to members that this legislation really conforms in statute what the practice had been relative to unallotment, with the exception of last year, and the Supreme Court's decision of last week confirms that concern. Additionally, we wanted to make sure, and depending on when this bill was heard, the effective date may or may not make any difference. At this point, it probably does not. We wanted to make sure that it was effective, and we had some lengthy conversations about this, as to what the best effective date was, and decided that the day following final enactment would be the best effective date, and it would be to any reductions made on or after that date. So it was not going to be a look back. Let's say the Supreme Court still hadn't acted, and I was now presenting this bill. The intent was never to try to retroactively change what Governor Plenty did, and as you can tell by the last line, it's not intended to affect the validity or invalidity of actions taken before its effective date. So we were trying to look forward, not look backwards to last year. But I do think this, again, the Supreme Court decision of last week does provide a real balance to this legislative effort.
Senator Cohen, there's a couple questions I have. If the number or if the range is between 2% and 10%, do we need, or that no program may be eliminated, or can a 10% reduction cripple a program enough that it would actually be eliminated?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that thought, a good one is not contained within the bill. We wanted to make it clear that there could be no elimination. So
okay.
I don't know, I might defer to Mr. Mossman if that hypothetical might be there where a 10% reduction in effect becomes the elimination. It might be, let's say, the second year of biennium, and most of the money was expended in the first year of the biennium. And if a 10% reduction of the appropriation is all the money that's left in the account, then you do have the elimination
sure.
of the program.
Okay.
I think that was the guard. And I'm not sure, Mr. Mossman, if you would agree with that hypothetical, but I think that's what was intended.
Mr. Chair and members, that is my understanding of what was intended. The unallotments could happen in more than one set of actions during the course of the biennium. The 2% limit would always apply. The 10% limit would always apply, but in no case could the unallotment result in the elimination of the program.
Okay. So, Senator Roblin.
Thank you. Well, I'm trying to think of a real life situation here. So we have a political contribution refund, and it could be cut 10%, but the eligibility standards can't be changed. So they couldn't say that instead of giving back $50 per person, you could give back $40 per person. The governor would not have the authority to do that. So the program would run out of money at some point if the forecast had been accurate as to how many people might want to use it. But then the program would be over because there'd be no more money in that appropriation. So does that mean he can't cut the 10%? Because he can't change the amount to be reimbursed.
Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, Cyril Blaine, I think you're correct relative, and I'm going to defer to Mr. Watson on this one. I think you'd be correct in terms of the program because it does reference the $50. But if the program is going to run out of money, then I would suggest. I'm not sure your hypothetical works because the program. First of all, if you can't unallot any dollar from that program because it would change the eligibility standard, then that would be off limits. If there's a program that is not off limits, whatever it is, and you're suggesting the money would run out, the unallotment would only be for 10% of that program. So the money couldn't run out unless, let's say, we got into the cash flow problems that we talked about earlier this afternoon. So I'm not quite sure it works,
Senator Cohen.
Appropriations
cap. Senator Cohen and Senator Roebling, I think the paragraph C would actually come to play there too, but must not otherwise modify formulas. I don't know if that would be considered a formula, the $50 or not, but or eligibility standards. You can have a program that doesn't function because there's no money, but you haven't eliminated the program. We have had that happen before where you have an unfunded program that just exists.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe a better example might be or to dovetail with Senator Roebling's example, possibly might be the cash flow issue where, let's say the PCR program was still in effect and everybody's getting their $50. And then because of cash flow problems, there's concern about payment of the $50. So I don't know if members saw, I think some members might have seen the memorandum from Commissioner Hansen that was sent out, I think, yesterday, that where the request is being made to agencies that where they can delay payments legally, that they delay payments.
So let's say in the case of the campaign finance board, which of course is independently operated, but let's say that hypothetically the governor could go to the campaign finance board and say, don't send out the $50 until our cash flow situation is better. That might be the way that you would deal with something like that. I'm not sure you'd actually eliminate the appropriation. That's how the money would run out, would be a cash flow issue, I think.
Mr. Mossman has an example that might...
Mr. Chair and members, if this is helpful, I think another example of the formula issue versus in terms of how the these unallotment statute would be met would be the recent unallotment of the renter's property tax refund payment, where in making the unallotment, the governor's action included the moving of recognizing 19% of your rent paid as an assumption of what your property tax payment was in calculating the formula, changing the 19% to 15%. Well, 19 to 15% is about a 20% reduction, but because that percentage is part of a larger formula, renters would have been affected differently as a result of that calculation. So an alternative would have been that everyone's payments could have been calculated based on the 19% and then reduced by an even amount. So everyone could be reduced by 10% across the board. So the formula remains the same. The allocation from one filer to another remains the same, but everyone's refund is just clipped by 10%, as opposed to changing the formula, which would not be allowed under this language.
Senator Roblin?
Well, suppose we had the basic sliding child care program, and so they could cut it 10%, the governor could cut it 10%, not allowed to do any eligibility standards. So the person who was at 250% of the federal poverty guideline would then have to take a proportional cut as the person who's at 75% of the federal poverty guideline. They would have no discretion in saying, we're going to reduce the eligibility standards because we only have a cutting of 10%. So we're going to reduce the guidelines so that only people at 225% of the federal poverty guideline can get money, the others are bumped off, and then the lower ones continue to get the same amount. But this would not allow that, right? I mean, it wouldn't allow any changes like that. So, I'm a little worried about that because I think maybe it just means they have to call us back into special session more often, because I don't think we would want the lowest people cut the same as the higher income people, because it would have a bigger impact on them.
Senator Higgins?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Roblin, what you were just talking about, though, was a change in public policy, and that's what we're supposed to do. It's not supposed to be something that's done as an after-the-fact budget-fixing remedy by the governor. I mean, changing the amount in the sliding fee child care from 250% of poverty to 225, that's our job to make that determination, and I think that's what this bill is
recommending. And Mr.
Chair, 10%, but then it will just be appropriated differently.
Senator Cohen.
And Mr. Chairman, as I listen to you, Senator Roblin, I think the combination of you and Senator Higgins hits upon where these parameters would require, arguably, a special session. That if the governor wants to change, not this governor, but any governor wants to change the sliding fee scale for child care, if the governor wants to change other kinds of eligibility standards, then you would need legislative authority to do that, not be able to do it unilaterally, as appeared to be the case last year.
Okay, Senator Tomasoni.
I don't think we're talking about the same thing as part of the language. It seems to me like the 10% applies to the appropriation that has been given from the budget to the program, not an amount that is given out after the program has begun. So if we give $1 million to the program, which gives out $50
Mr. Mossman? Or Mr. Watson?
I think you're looking at the right language. On 2.6, they reduce payments to all recipients in proportion to their payments. As long as the reduction is in proportion to the amount the person has received, if everybody is receiving $50, then it could be reduced by 10% or up to $5. But not everybody's going to receive $50, right? Some people, they only contributed 25. They can have a percentage of their 25 back, but it's got to be the same percentage for everybody so that it is in proportion to their payments. Okay, it's not the same dollar amount for everybody. It would be in proportion to their payments. And then the human services hypo, but sliding fee that you were talking about, again, it's in proportion to the payment that they receive, regardless of what their income might be and what they require in order to be eligible for the program. You take a look at the payment they're entitled to and then slash that by a uniform amount. Maybe it's 10, maybe it's 5, but it would have to be the same proportion for everybody. Does that help any?
No.
Then on the issue of the appropriation, the 10%, as Senator Tomasoni points out, that's really at the higher level of the total appropriation, not more than 10%.
And are they in conflict with each other?
No. No, not really. The requirement is that within that appropriation, okay, you can cut your $100,000, but you may be doing different things for different people who are parts of different programs that are funded by that same appropriation. You know, especially in human services, we have these huge hundreds of millions of dollars appropriations that fund many different programs. And you could treat different programs within that appropriation differently, as long as whoever was in a particular program is treated the same proportionally to the payment that they would otherwise receive. So maybe you've got a 10% or 20% or 50% reduction for some program, but everybody in the program gets the same reduction. So when you take all those different programs and the different rates of reduction, add them together, the total amount of the appropriation that can be reduced is the 10%.
Senator,
not per program.
Senator,
it's 10% of the overall appropriation.
Senator Tomasoni?
Senator Rowling's point is a really good one. If you're going to reduce payments to all recipients in proportion to the payments, isn't that in effect modifying the formula of eligibility standards or special criteria?
Mr. Watson?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I don't think so, because
there may be percentages.
You go ahead and you calculate what they would be entitled to under the statutory formulas and eligibility standards and so forth, but then you reduce that amount by a uniform percentage for the program. So they don't get what they might be entitled to.
I understand, but since we were giving the governor the exact authority, we don't want to be able to do it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and members, just on Senator Tomasoni's point, obviously the unallotment law, if it remains at all, assumes that if unallotment is used, there's going to be less money for someone or something, and this tries to corral how that someone, some amount, and for whom is allocated. And to amplify Mr. Watson's point, under human services, some of those appropriations are, like you said, hundreds of millions of dollars with maybe dozens of programs underneath them. So no program could be eliminated. The 10% applies to the overall appropriation.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Senator Tomasoni. Clearly there are limits placed on the governor. I try to do the comparison from the information I had as to what had happened in the past to show how this executive authority had been used in a relatively sparing way by governors, both Democratic governors and Republican governors, including Governor Plenty. If the issue is whether or not we should have any kind of an unallotment statute whatsoever, obviously this bill doesn't do that. And I don't support that. Most states in the country, again, I was trying to pick it up from the NCSL information, but almost every state in the country has some type of unallotment authority. Ours tends, as I mentioned, to be a fairly broad and one of the few states that has an unencumbered authority, at least prior to the Supreme Court. But certainly, if there are unusual situations, emergency kinds of situations, it's appropriate that the governor would have unallotment authority. I think the issue was that we thought last year's action was overreaching, and I'm not going to suggest whether the Supreme Court opinion was decided incorrectly or not, but the Supreme Court felt the same. But I do defend the use of an allotment or the existence of some type of authority. This just makes it a more narrow authority and conforms, I would argue, to the usage of with prior allotments other than last year.
Senator Cohen, is there any other discussion?
Yes,
Chairman.
Mr. Watson.
Just to respond to Senator Cohen's first question, it is every state and the Northern Mariana Islands and Puerto Rico, but not American Samoa, the District of Columbia, Guam, or the Virgin Islands.
Okay, thank you for that
information.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, I did pick up some of the territories, but I didn't have a chance to really analyze exactly which territory, because in the NCSL information, there's a blank space with all the territories. I didn't quite pick up which ones.
All right. Senator Cohen, let's see. I believe we moved the amendment, adopted the amendment, so.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 2566 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, Senator Cohen moves that Senate File 2566 as amended be recommended to be passed and goes to the floor, right? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, that would conclude the agenda. I don't think we have anything else, do we, in front of us? So, members, this is it. Well, no. For the Finance Committee.
All right, thank you, Senator Cohen.